could possibly be the right way. Now that the dog's calm, he settles the thing on the floor by telling you that we're in love, that we want to be together. I know that hurts to hear, and believe me, we've struggled with it ourselves. But I throw back my head and shout hard enough to burn the back of my throat. She's married, you asshole! The words bounce around the house and fall into a silence so absolute it rings in my ears. I understand that, Jeffrey, and I'm sorry. Truly. You can't even imagine how sorry, but swear to God, Sabine and I didn't set out intending to break up two families. It just happened. And this isn't just some fling. This is the realest, most genuine thing I've ever felt. Sabine is my soulmate. I love her. I adore her. She's the best thing that's ever happened to me. His speech might have worked on another man. His words might have been a balm on a brittle, broken heart. Sabine will be loved, cared for, cherished. He's not stealing her out of greed or spite, but because he has no choice, because their connection is too great to ignore. Only an asshole stands in the way of soulmates. But we've already established that I'm a bitter, bitter man. Well then, Trevor, I feel obliged to tell you that this woman you cherish so much, your soulmate? The fur bag sniffs at my shoe, and I push it away with a foot. She's missing. Trevor makes a face like I punched him in his perfectly sculpted abs. What do you mean, Sabina's missing? Missing, missing? I nod. She had a showing last night with Corey Porter and his family, I know. The doctor stops, waiting for me to continue, but I'm still processing the fact that he knows more about my wife's business than I do, than even Ingrid does. As much as I'd love to leave him hanging, I need to know what he knows. I fix him with a defiant stare. She never came home. She never? He swallows the rest, but his expression is screaming the words. Came home. Sabine never came home. She didn't show up, and neither did her car. Okay, let's think about this logically. I mean, she was pretty sure Corey would pull the trigger on the house. Maybe he did. Maybe they went out after to celebrate. Maybe. But now it's the next day. Did you call her? I sigh, roll my eyes. Of course you called her, but... Trevor runs a shaking hand through his hair. What about Ingrid? Did you call her? Did you call the police? Yes to both. Ingrid was at my house when the detective got there. He was going to check out the show house, see if he saw anything out of the ordinary. That was hours ago. Trevor's eyes go wide with fear, with horror. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. He stumbles into the kitchen, and I follow behind. I step on one of the dog's squeaky toys, and the beast comes running. Trevor leans against the kitchen counter, tapping numbers into a cordless phone with his thumb. He presses the phone to his ear, muttering, "Come on, come on, come on." And then his shoulders slump, and he curses. "Babe, it's me. Jeffrey's here, and he said you never came home last night. Wherever you are, please call me, okay? The very second you get this, I need to know you're okay, that you're... I'm scared shitless. I love you. Call me." He hangs up. And I almost feel sorry for the bastard. He begins pacing, his bare feet slapping the hardwood floor. Now what? Under the kitchen can lights, his face is green and shiny, sweating despite the air conditioning. What are we going to do now? I shake my head, battling a rush of disgust at his use of the word we. You and I are not on the same team here. We do not share Sabine. She's my wife. She's nothing to you. He stops, takes a long, slow breath. When is the last time you talked to your wife? Yesterday morning. And then she texted me later in the day that she had a showing, but she'd be home by 9. When's the last time you talked to my wife? Has anybody confirmed that she actually made it to the showing? Did she meet Corey and his wife at the house? I shrug. Like I said, I haven't heard anything from the detective, so I'm guessing so. What time? Did anybody call Corey to ask? You're the first person I've talked to who knows who the showing was with. The most I could tell the detective was the name of Sabine's boss. He turns and races from the room, his footsteps crashing up the stairs. While he's gone, I take a look around, try to see the place like Sabine would, like she did when she showed it to her soon-to-be lover. I picture her leading him through the empty house, pointing out all the features. Open, rambling rooms with French doors and generous windows. A spacious kitchen with new stainless appliances. Custom molding and hardwood floors throughout. Was her first kiss under the arched doorway? Did he push her up against these granite countertops? The visions burn like acid in my eyes, and I rub them away. The floor creaks above my head. I open the fridge and study the contents. Definitely a doctor's refrigerator. Milk, fruit, yogurt. Enough vegetables to stock a produce department. Nothing even remotely unhealthy except a lone IPA, shoved to the very back behind a container of organic pineapple. I'm digging it out when Trevor returns with a shirt, thank God, and his cell. Corey's not answering his phone, he tells me, and neither is Lisa. I shut the refrigerator and wave the beer in the air by my head. Where do you keep your opener? Trevor ignores me, staring at the phone in his hand. The first drawer I try is stuffed with pencils and post-its, so I close it and keep going, moving down the island, opening and closing drawers in search of a bottle opener. On the third try, I find one, a golf-themed piece of plastic that makes a cheering sound when I open the cap. I toss it back into the drawer mid-hurrah. You never answered my question, I say. When is the last time you talked to Sabine? He looks up, and his eyes are liquid. She came by the hospital yesterday afternoon. She wasn't there very long, only 15 minutes or so. She left around 1:30. I stare at him across the island. At 1:30 yesterday afternoon, I was in Little Rock, fretting about the canyon that's cracked down the middle of my marriage, and plotting the steps I can take to win my wife back, oblivious to the fact that she was more than likely being fucked by her lover in a hospital supply closet. "Would you stop looking at me like that?" he says. "Sabine is missing. It's just that I'm having trouble letting go of the fact that she made time in her day to go to the hospital for 15 minutes with you, when she can never squeeze in a lunch with me. She's hardly ever home for dinner." Trevor sinks onto a stool at the counter, shoving aside a coloring book and a solo cup packed with colorful markers. "What about her car? Has anyone seen it?" "Not that I know of. Ingrid gave the detective her license plate number, though, so I'm assuming he's on the lookout." I take a long pull from the bottle, then make a face. It's one of those snobby IPAs, bitter and aggressively hoppy. I check the label and see it's also organic. "Do you have any normal beer?" Trevor plucks a blue marker from the cup. "What's his name?" "Whose name?" "The detective. What's his name?" "Oh, something Durand. Mike or Mark or something like that." I pour the rest of the IPA down the drain while Trevor calls 911 and demands to be put through to the detective. He uses his doctor's voice, polite but overly self-important, each word delivered in a tone that commands attention. He introduces himself. "Dr. Trevor McAdams, chief obstetrician at Jefferson Regional, romantically involved with Sabine for the past 5 months." Then rattles off Corey's name and number. Sabine's schedule until the moment she left the hospital, at some time around 1:30. Her cell, plus another number I didn't know existed, for a phone I didn't know she had. The entire conversation lasts no longer than 5 minutes. He thanks the person and hangs up. I slam the bottle onto the counter with a clap, and the dog, who'd curled into a sleepy ball on its bed by the table, looks up with a start. 5 months? Trevor frowns. "You told the detective just now that you and Sabine have been romantically involved for 5 fucking months. Those were his words. "Romantically involved." The beer turns to acid in my throat. "Like I said, this isn't the way we wanted you to find out, but can we drop the guilt trip for a minute? At least until Sabine is found." I grip the granite with both hands. 5 months ago, Sabine started to cringe whenever I'd touch her. She started turning her head when I kissed her, and complaining about headaches any time I reached for her in bed. I thought it was me. But it was you, wasn't it? Trevor sighs, and he lifts a hand from the counter. I don't know what to tell you, Jeffrey. That phone number you gave the detective just now, let me guess. Sabine got it when she started seeing you, didn't she? He doesn't answer, but his expression tells me it's a yes. Sabine has a secret phone. She got a separate device so she can talk to Trevor without me knowing. A Trevor hotline. He opens the coloring book, scribbles across a smiling Dumbo in bright purple marker. Corey lives in those gated condos on Old Warren Road. He must know something. I need to know what it is. He rips out the sheet and holds it across the counter to me, waiting for me to take it. Please, Jeffrey, my kids are upstairs. I can't leave them. My wife... He shakes his head. She's already taking me to the cleaners. I can't have her taking them, too. Please. I sigh, a hard huff filled with resentment and something sharper. Something that gnaws at me like hunger. But for revenge. When I get home, I'm going to look up the number for this guy's wife and volunteer as a witness. You do realize that Sabine leaves her shit all over the house, right? If you actually lived with her, if you spent time with her on a regular basis, you'd know she's demanding and forgetful and selfish. That she pees with the door open and she hogs the couch and she never bothers cleaning up her own dishes. You don't want her because she's your soulmate. You only want her because she's not yours. He gives the paper a shake. Please talk to Corey. Don't do it for me. Do it for Sabine. For our... He stops himself just in time, but it's too late. I already understand. I heard the words he didn't want to say. You motherfucking fucker! I pause, the realization lighting me up from inside. Hot, smoldering coals that seethe in my stomach and spread outward until my limbs feel like they're on fire. One good spark and I'll blow. She's pregnant, isn't she? He doesn't nod, but his eyes are glassy in the dim light. Finally, after all these years of wishing and wanting and eventually giving up entirely, Sabine is pregnant. With Trevor's child. His gaze dips to the paper. Please, he says, and his voice breaks on the word. I take the paper, but then I stalk around the island and punch him in the face.
Beth. That night, you come to me in my sleep, a blur of lightning limbs and shouted curses tearing through the house, opening and slamming doors, whipping off pillows and bed covers, flipping couches and tables, ripping pictures off the wall. You are searching for something. For me. I teeter on the edge of awake. I see you gaining speed, moving closer, and my stomach clenches into a spiky knot. You puff your big chest and scream, and that lock of hair I used to love to run my fingers through falls flat on your sweaty forehead. You push it off with the back of a fist, and that's when I see the gun. Wake up! I pinch the skin of my arms, smack myself on the cheeks, but my legs, tangled in the sheets, are like lead. They won't move. Suddenly you're here, stomping down the hallway at Morgan House. The hollow thud of your footsteps trembles the floor, the walls, the lining around my heart. The noise stops in front of my door, and I am frozen with fear, with pure terror. My doorknob rattles, then goes still. I hold my breath, wait for the gun to go off. The door explodes, wood splinters showering down on me like a million deadly spikes. The hallway sconces light you up from behind, glowing underneath your skin like blood. I scream. You grin and aim the gun. I shoot upright in my bed, the scream ringing in my ears. I clamp a hand over my mouth and stare into the dark room, trying to get my bearings. My room. My bed at Morgan House. I'm safe. You're not here. It was only a dream. And yet, was it? The back of my throat burns in a way that tells me the scream might have been real. But the ache could also be from the sobbing. My cheeks are slick. The hair at my temples damp with sweat or tears. I mop my face with a sheet and take several deep breaths, willing my hammering heart to slow. I check the time on my cell phone. 4 a.m. Somewhere above me, a male body is snoring loud enough to rattle the floorboards. And I wonder what this says about my housemates, that they are either deaf or sleep like the dead. Or maybe they are immune to a stranger's scream ripping through their slumber. Miss Sally runs a tight ship, but this place is an oasis in a questionable neighborhood, one where the houses sport bars on the windows. This doesn't bode well for me if my nightmare turns to reality. What will they do if you find me here? Sleep through the screams? Hide behind the locked doors of their bedrooms? Suddenly the room is too hot, the four walls shrinking around me. I kick off the twisted sheets and reach for my shorts in a wadded pile on the floor. I need a glass of water. Or maybe a cup of tea if I can swipe a tea bag from somebody's supply. Mostly, I need to get out of this room. I strap my money belt around my waist, pluck my keys and phone from the nightstand, and creep into the hall, locking the door behind me. The hallway is dark, lit only at the far end by a street lamp somewhere outside the window. I move, breathless and on tiptoe toward its golden gleam, the pads of my bare feet silent on the polyester runner. The stairs are trickier, sagging and creaky in the middle. I hug the side instead, my fingertips skimming the walls, following them to the kitchen. A single bulb above the stove casts faint light on the scuffed linoleum floor, but otherwise the room is a black hole. I power on my cell, use the light of the screen to guide the way to the cabinets on the far wall. The first one is dinnerware, neat stacks of plates and bowls and plastic cups. I shut it and move down the line. Cleaning supplies, pots and pans. But not a single crumb of food. No box of dusty tea bags.
You must be the new girl,
a female voice says from behind me. A grenade erupts in my chest and I whirl around, searching for her face in the darkness. The shadows shift, and the ceiling lamp buzzes to life, blinding me with sudden light. I cover my eyes, squinting through my fingers at the woman sitting cross-legged atop the kitchen table. Caramel skin and big brown eyes and the body of a 50s film star, petite but curvy. She watches me with barefaced curiosity.
What are you looking for? Maybe I can help you find it.
She's as pretty as her accent, a South American cadence slowed with a southern drawl. Two silver discs hang on delicate chains from her neck, each of them engraved with something I can't quite make out from this distance. Names, I'm guessing. I wasn't expecting to find anyone here, not when the money belt hanging from my middle is about as subtle as a third breast. I pull on my too tight t-shirt, fold my arms across my waist.
You scared the shit out of me. Was that you upstairs?
She pauses.
I heard somebody scream just now. Was that you?
Shit. So that part wasn't a dream. My face goes hot, thinking of all the sleeping bodies upstairs.
Sorry, did I wake you?
How many others did I rouse from their slumber?
No, my room is right next to Ned's.
She points to the ceiling, the boards above our head rumbling like a faraway train. Ned, I assume.
Anyway, tell me what you came down here looking for, and I'll tell you where you can find it. Though I will warn you, Miss Sally keeps the good stuff locked in the pantry.
Oh. Miss Sally's warnings ring in my ear. Her honor code, and the hidden cameras everywhere. But surely a teabag doesn't count as stealing, especially if I replace it first thing tomorrow.
I was hoping to borrow a teabag, actually. Well, that's easy enough.
She hops off the table and pads on bare feet across the room. Her shorts are the kind a cheerleader would wear, skin tight and Daisy Duke short.
I've got a box of Lipton. Hope that's okay.
You once hurled a full cup of piping hot tea at my head because it was Lipton. You said if you'd wanted a cup of hot piss, you would have asked for some. I smile.
Lipton is perfect, thank you.
She pulls a yellow box from a drawer by the microwave, flips on the electric kettle, drops the bags and two mugs she finds in a cabinet.
So what were you doing down here?
I say, gesturing to the table.
Why were you sitting here in the dark? I was meditating.
Seriously? It's not at all what I was expecting. She doesn't seem like the type. Too fidgety, too va-va-voom to be that grounded.
In the middle of the night? Why not? Meditation relieves stress, increases concentration, clears your mind, and calms your nerves.
She closes her eyes, holds her hands in the air, palms to the sky in a classic meditation pose. I notice a tattoo that pokes out from the collar of her white tank top, winding down the skin of one arm. The other is covered in bracelets, leather, and bright, colorful beads. Her eyes pop open, her gaze finding mine.
I'll teach you sometime. Honestly, I'm glad to have another one of us here. Another female, I mean. We're the only ones if you don't count Miss Sally. I don't know if you've noticed yet, but this place is boiling over with testosterone.
Her rapid-fire change of subjects is dizzying to my sleep-deprived brain, and I sink onto a chair at the table. I consider which part of her monologue to latch onto, the meditation, the proffer of friendship, the gender imbalance in this place. But she's already moved on.
I take it you're new in town, she says.
Just got here, actually. How long have you lived here?
Atlanta or Morgan House?
I shrug. Both, I guess.
I'm a Grady baby, born and raised.
She leans a hip against the counter, taking in my frown.
Oh, sorry. Grady's the hospital downtown where they take all the gunshot patients and moms too strung out to know they're pushing out a baby. I spent 6 weeks in one of those heated bubbles, sweating the crack and Lord knows what else out of my system. By the time I was clean, my mom was long gone. They handed me over to foster care.
Her story has a few holes. Her accent, for one. Even if her foster parents were Latino, even if she grew up speaking Spanish at home, would her accent really be that strong? And why would someone born and raised in this city end up here, in a boarding house that caters to transients? Still, no way I'm planning to ask. The less she tells me about her life, the less she'll expect me to tell her about mine. I'm sorry, I say instead. The foster system is tough. She shrugs, a what-can-you-do gesture.
The worst part is not being wanted by anyone. That really messes with your head, you know? It can make you feel worthless if you let it.
She pulls a bear-shaped bottle from the cabinet by the fridge and waves it next to her face.
Honey?
I nod, even though I don't usually take my tea sweet. My stomach is sharp with hunger, and honey will help. She squirts a generous blob in each mug, reaches in a drawer for two spoons.
I'm Martina, by the way.
A first name, nothing else. I follow her lead. I'm Beth.
Nice to meet you, Beth.
She grins at me over her shoulder.
How are you liking it here at Morgan House?
I haven't really been here long enough to know, and you're the only other person I've met besides Miss Sally. I lower my voice to a whisper. She scares me a little. Martina turns, swiping a hand through the air, her bracelets jangling.
Oh, don't you worry about Miss Sally. As long as you're cool, she's cool. Ditto for most of the people staying here. They might need more than a 3-minute shower, but they keep to themselves mostly. And they won't grab your ass or try to steal your shit because they know Miss Sally would eat them for supper. Keep your head down and don't ruffle any feathers and you'll do fine. How long will you be staying?
I don't know. It depends on how quickly I can get a job. The kettle clicks off, the water gurgling in a rolling boil, and she pours it into the mugs.
The place I work for is always looking for some new help. Nothing fancy, just mopping floors and scrubbing sinks, but still. The work is steady, and it pays enough to afford the rent here.
Your voice bubbles up in my head as clearly as if you were sitting at the table across from me.
No such thing as a free lunch. Somebody offers you something, you best be thinking about what they want in return, because they always want something.
I study Martina's back as she dunks the tea bags up and down, up and down. And I wonder what she wants from me. The money strapped to my belly, most likely. She glances over her shoulder.
Don't like cleaning toilets, huh?
I push her words aside and flip the script. Tell myself this isn't about what this girl wants from me, but what I want from her. The thing is, I already know that becoming Beth Murphy, really becoming her, is a pain in the ass and maybe an impossible one. I need a Georgia driver's license, and for that I need documents that seem as elusive to me as sprouting fairy wings or finding a flying unicorn. A birth certificate, a social security card, and not one but two documents proving residency, something like a utility or credit card bill. Miss Sally doesn't seem like the type who could be persuaded into slapping my name onto a rental agreement for a couple of crisp bills. I'm pretty sure she'd toss me onto the street if I even asked. And what about the other documents? The utility bills, the birth certificate and social security card? My Photoshop skills are nowhere near good enough, and I'm pretty sure forging a government-issued document is a felony. It's not that I mind cleaning toilets, I say. It's just that I lost my ID. Martina gives me a look.
You lost it, huh? That happens a lot around here.
She carries the mugs to the table and holds one out to me.
You don't have anything? Not even an old, expired one?
Especially not that. My Arkansas license is a charred lump at the bottom of a hotel trash can four states away. I take the tea and shake my head. But according to the internet, this city has more than 300,000 undocumented workers. The question isn't if there are jobs here, but where to find them.
I can still get a job without one, right?
She sinks onto the table, swinging her legs onto the wooden surface and crossing them underneath her, resuming her old position.
Sure, if you don't mind working construction or cleaning rich ladies' houses. Know any Buckhead Bettys?
I open my mouth to answer, but she waves me off.
Never mind, you do not want to work for one of those bitches, I can promise you that. What I meant was you'll need a roster of regular customers, people with big houses who don't mind paying you cash under the table.
My stomach sinks. The only people I know in this city are you and Miss Sally.
Miss Sally can maybe help you, but I can't. I try to stay out of the northern suburbs.
She blows over the surface of her tea, regarding me with a thoughtful expression.
How much money you got in that bag strapped to your waist?
The hand I press to the bag is automatic, as is the expression on my face, a mixture of distrust and defiance. Don't even fucking try it. Martina laughs.
Come on, chica. I already told you people here don't try to steal your shit, and that includes me. Though it's probably not a bad idea to keep your cash on your person at all times. What I'm asking is if you would be willing to part with some of it. Because if you are, I might know where you could find an ID.
I lean back on my chair, eyeing her with suspicion. My hand is still on my money belt, my legs still ready to pounce. I'm bigger than Martina, and thanks to you, I know the most effective places to land a punch. Kneecap, face, solar plexus, throat, temple. I'll be back upstairs, barricaded behind the door of my room before she stops writhing on the floor. But an ID would solve a lot of problems.
How much?
I say warily.
Last I heard, Jorge charges somewhere in the neighborhood of $300. You can probably talk him down some if you find him in a good mood. The hard part is finding him in a good mood.
Is he any good?
The best. The Rolls Royce of fake IDs. That's why he's so expensive.
I sip my tea and do the math.
$300 is a lot of cash, almost 2 weeks' worth of rent and 15% of my rapidly dwindling stash. But if Jorge is as good as Martina says he is, it might be worth the money. Finding a job will be so much faster and easier if Beth is legit. And you? Martina looks up from her mug, her brows sliding into a frown.
And me what?
How much do you charge for telling me where to find this Jorge person? Martina looks at me for a moment, letting the silence linger. Her expression is that of someone making a hard decision, and I know what she's thinking. How much is the information worth to me? How much is too much? Your words run through my head. No such thing as a free lunch. And I hate you even more for being right.
Las Tortas Locas on Jimmy Carter Boulevard,
she says finally, unfolding her legs and pushing to a stand, walking with her mug to the door.
Consider it your housewarming gift.
Jeffrey. A pounding on the front door lurches me out of a dead sleep. I sit up on the couch and rub my face, blinking into the room. The only light comes from a thin slice of morning sunshine, where the curtains don't quite meet, blanching a strip of carpet. I check my watch. 11 a.m. I've been asleep for all of 2 hours. The past 2 days have been a shit show. Coming home to find Sabine missing, discovering she's been screwing around. My surprise rendezvous with her lover, Trevor accidentally spilling the beans about the pregnancy. By the time I drove across town to Sabine's client, then did the same with her boss, every muscle in my body was knotted up, my skin vibrating with fury. Corey and Lisa told me exactly what they told the detective, that Sabine never showed up for the showing. There's another pounding at the door, followed by 3 rapid-fire rings of the doorbell. I push off the couch and stumble to the door. Ingrid doesn't look like she's slept much either, but she's cleaned up since the last time I saw her. She's fresh from the shower. Her hair is still damp, the ends gathered in wet clumps, dripping onto her dress, some awful blue and white thing. She barrels into my foyer, and I catch a whiff of her perfume, cloying and sweet. She takes in my T-shirt and rumpled sweats, the same ones I was wearing the last time she was here, and frowns. Why aren't you dressed? Didn't you get my messages? I wince, pressing down on my throbbing temples with a thumb and middle finger. Ingrid's volume, louder than usual, isn't helping what's pounding in my head like a hangover. And then there's that constant edge to her voice. I can't take much of her on a good day. Now, after 2 bad days in a row, she's chipping away at my last threads of civility. Clearly not.
Well, go upstairs and change. We're due at the police department in 30 minutes. The detective has an update.
My heart bangs a slow, heavy beat. An update could be anything. Her car, found wrapped around a tree. Her body, found rotting in a field of soybeans. Her killer, on the loose or locked behind bars.
What kind of update? I don't know, Jeffrey. He wouldn't tell me anything other than he had some news.
She chews on a corner of her lips, which are already red and cracked. Her eyes are fat pink pillows.
What if he...
She stops herself before she can finish, and I don't touch it. A detective calling with news he wouldn't share over the phone can't be good. I turn and head upstairs for a quick shower. 9.5 minutes later, I'm crammed into the passenger seat of Ingrid's Acura, barreling south toward the police station. Traffic is light, but on the other side of her windshield, it's gearing up to be another blistering day. I turn the air conditioning to high and aim the vents at my face. Trevor's news last night lit me on fire, and I've been burning up ever since. I suppose you knew about the baby. Ingrid stares straight ahead, hands at 10 and 2, but she nods.
Sabine and I
tell each other everything, I know. I glare out the side window at the storefronts flashing by. I wish I'd thought to bring sunglasses. What else have the two of you been keeping from me?
She's been talking to a lawyer. She was going to ask you for a divorce this weekend.
The news hits me like an anvil. Not that Sabine was planning to leave me. Trevor already told me as much. But at the implication, she saw a lawyer. Something that's easy to verify. I don't need to be a detective to know how it makes me look. Like I have a motive. I snort. That's convenient, isn't it? What is? The timing. Sabine disappears, pregnant with another man's child, right as she's about to file for divorce from a husband who once, and only once, so help me God, lost his temper. If I were the detective, I'd be calling me in for questioning, too. I twist on my seat, turning to face Ingrid. Is that what this is? Is that why you came by the house to haul me in for questioning? Did he send you to lure me into the station? I'm pretty sure the detective can haul you in himself if he wants to. She gives me the same guilty side eye Sabine does, right before she admits to having ruined my favorite sweater in the laundry. But to be perfectly honest, I came to get you because I can't do this alone. Sit in some sterile room at the police station while the detective tells me something awful has happened to my sister. I'm terrified. And I couldn't bring Mom. She wouldn't understand. And even if she did, I can't deal with her and bad news at the same time. As much as I hate to admit it, I need you there. Why didn't you call Trevor? She presses her lips together. You did call him. He wouldn't come. He's a mess. She punches the gas to make it through a light, then merges into the far left lane. And he was right. Having him there would only make everything worse. At least I won't have to take care of you. I'm not quite sure how to take that. Her mother would be too clueless, Trevor would be too emotional, and I would be my usual asshole self. I choose to focus on the words she doesn't say, that I'm strong, solid, sensible. No matter what the detective has to tell us, at least I won't go apeshit. But is she right? I think about what I'd do if the detective tells me Sabine is dead or asks to swab the inside of my cheek. What will my reaction be then? I look over at Ingrid, at her pointy features and shiny profile, and think I really don't want to do this alone either. It's ironic, I say, turning back to the traffic. What is? That it took Sabine disappearing to make us actually want to be in a room together.
Beth. For a boulevard named after a former peanut farmer turned president, it's nothing like I expected. A magnolia-lined avenue, maybe, or a winding country road slicing through rolling green fields would be fitting. Not this six-lane thoroughfare that packs the Buick Regal on all sides with bumper-to-bumper traffic. I cling to the far right lane, keep a safe distance between my car and the guy riding the brakes in front of me, and search the storefronts for Las Tortas Locas. I spotted up ahead a giant margarita glass jutting above the rooftops like a crown jewel. I swerve into the turn lane and head toward the building, a riot of flashing neon lights squeezed between a strip mall and a drive-through bank. I pull into the lot, and mariachi music rattles the Buick's tinted windows. The inside is even worse. Music blares from the ceiling speakers, mixing with the din of a full house of diners and the hard chinks of porcelain and glass. The hostess has to cup a palm around her ear when I yell at her who I'm here to see, and then she points me to a table at the far end of the restaurant. "Are you sure?" I shout, squinting at the man across the room. Even from here, from clear across the room, the man doesn't match the name. "I'm here for Jorge. Jorge!" She leans on the hostess stand with an elbow, and I catch a slight roll of her eyes. "That's him, and I heard you the first time." I wind my way through the tables to Jorge, 400 pounds of a milky white man eating a burrito the size of his forearm. I hover at the edge of his table, waiting for him to stop shoveling food long enough to notice me. This Jorge guy may not be Latino, but he's no stranger to churros. He looks up, and his eyes are thin slits, part genetics,
part his cheeks, squeezing them shut. It looks like he's glaring at me, and maybe that's exactly what he's doing. Martina said he was in a perpetually bad mood. He picks up a hard-shelled taco loaded with meat and cheese and dunks it in salsa.
Martina gave me your name,
I say finally. I lean closer, across what looks to be a bucket of refried beans smothered with cheese.
She said you could help me get an ID.
What kind?
His accent sounds Asian. A driver's license, for Georgia preferably, and maybe a social security card if you're able.
He gives me a look, and I don't know if it's to say he does or doesn't have one.
$400.
He shoves the taco, the whole entire thing, into his mouth. For both?
Yep,
he says around a mouthful of meat.
But Martina told me three.
The slits all but disappear. I give him time to swallow some of the food bulging in his already swollen cheeks.
$300 for license only. $400 for both.
Barter, you say in my head. For you, haggling is a sport, a competition. You will hold up the grocery store line to bicker about the price for dented cans and boxes torn at the edges.
Say it like you mean it.
You tell me now.
There's always wiggle room in a price. Always.
$350,
I say.
$375.
A shard of ground beef flies from Jorge's mouth and ricochets off my leg. I make a face, edge backward until I am out of range. I will never eat Mexican again. I nod.
Deal.
Jorge tells me to meet him in an hour at a strip mall a few miles from here. He slides the beans closer, reaching for his spoon, and rattles off an address I commit to memory. That's it. Meeting over. I beat a semi-straight path to the door before he changes his mind. For the next 45 minutes, I sit in my car in the restaurant's parking lot, listening to the radio and killing time. People come and go in a constant stream. Construction workers and folks in business attire. Moms with hair like mine emerging from a minivan full of kids. It's the weirdest combination of diners I've ever seen. And I think of Jorge, the way he shoveled in those tacos faster than he could chew. The food here must really be something. My gaze sticks to a figure at the far edge of the lot. She's everything a woman in a neighborhood like this one is not supposed to be. Alone, half hidden behind a holly bush, completely oblivious to her surroundings, her head is down, her thumbs flying across her phone, and even from all the way across the lot I can tell she's a perfect mark. Designer bag slung over her shoulder, a honker of a diamond on her finger. The stone winks in the afternoon sunlight, along with matching ones in each ear. A car slows alongside her, and one by one the hairs on the back of my neck soldier to a stand.
Look up, lady! Look up! Look up! Look up!
I say into my empty car. No way she can hear me, but still, I say it loud and with authority, like anyone who's ever taken a self-defense class would know to do. Straight punch to the throat, knee kick to the groin, elbow in the nose. Basic moves, simple techniques every woman should have in her arsenal, both potent and effective. But this woman doesn't look up. Doesn't even glance at the car. Las Tortas Locas is apparently a hotbed for criminal activity, and she might as well have hung a sign over her head, advertising herself as easy prey.
Shit, lady, come on!
The car is completely stopped now, and I spot two shadowed figures behind the opaque windows who are not here for the taco special. I know it with everything inside me, my queasy stomach, my itchy skin. A cell-deep awareness that something is about to happen. Something bad. My fingers wander to my steering wheel, the heel of my hand hovering over the horn, while my brain shuffles through the scenarios. Leaning on the horn might scare off the bad guys and save the woman's jewels, but it might also get me noticed. It would mean her asking my name, noting my license plate, looking at me as a hero, or worse, a witness.
Beth Murphy's life would be over before it even began. This lady needs saving, but damn it, so do I. The passenger's door swings open, and a man steps out. Pale skin, slouchy jeans, faded and ripped gray sweatshirt. No, not a man, a kid. Tall and lanky, all shiny face and silly putty limbs, probably no more than 14. He leaves the door open, and if that's not a getaway move, I don't know what is. He stalks straight at her, and I scream into my car, "Put down the stupid phone!" But as hard as I try, I can't make my hand press on the horn. And so I sit, watching from 50 feet away while the kid whips out a gun and mugs her in broad daylight. Purse, phone, diamonds, watch, bracelets. She hands over everything with frantic, shaking hands. He forces her to the ground, his body language commanding her to hurry. She sputters and sobs, but she obeys, lying flat with both hands shielding the back of her head. Behind him, the car's tires squeal and smoke, and the kid lunges with his loot through the still-open door. The entire episode takes all of 60 seconds. As soon as the parking lot is quiet again, the woman clambers to her feet.
Help! Somebody help me! Help!
I tell myself it's fine, that she's fine. Scared and shaken, maybe, her white jeans smudged where they make contact with the dirty asphalt. But otherwise, everybody is fine. Everybody but me, trapped here in this lot. The woman is standing between me and the only exit. A gaggle of sorority types push out the restaurant's double doors, talking and laughing. They hear the woman's cries and stop on the concrete, their happy expressions falling into surprise.
I was robbed!
The woman screams at them.
He pointed a gun at my head and he took my wedding ring. He took everything. Oh my God, don't just stand there. Somebody call the police.
A tall blonde pulls out a cell phone, and I eyeball the curb height to the street, trying to judge if it's too high for the Buick to plow over without blowing out a tire. Would the women even notice? Would they jot down my license plate and hand it to the cops as a potential witness? And what if I don't leave, then what? What will I say when the police find me sitting here, hiding in my car? I glance at the clock on the dash. Less than 10 minutes until I'm supposed to meet Jorge. Even if I ditched my car and ran, I'd never make it on time. The women are all babbling now, gesturing and talking over each other, their expressions tight with a near miss. And guilt pushes up from somewhere deep inside me. All my life I've believed in karma, in the universal principle of cause and effect. Do good, and good comes to you. Do bad, and, well, you better watch your back. And today I stood by and watched a woman get mugged. What does the universe have in store for me now? The women storm inside, and I start the car and drive as fast as I dare, squealing into the strip mall Jorge directed me to a full 6 minutes late. I pray Jorge is not a punctual guy, the type who doesn't tolerate clients who show up later than promised. Then again, I am the client, and I'm guessing the black market ID business must by definition remain fluid. In the grand scope of things, 6 minutes isn't all that long. I step out of my car and scan the half dozen storefronts. Jorge didn't give me anything other than an address, so which one? Discount stores and carnicerias, a cell phone shop, a smashed window covered in butcher paper. And then at the far end, I spot a single word, fotografico. I slam the door and hurry to the store. Inside, the place is tiny, a shoebox of a room with a camera on a tripod, a register counter, and not much else. Jorge is waiting for me by the register, beside a man he introduces as Emmanuel, no last name. Emmanuel demands $6 in cash, then points me to a grubby white wall. Stand there. No smile. Emmanuel is a man of few words, but he gets the job done. There's a blinding flash, and by the time the spots have cleared from my vision, two passport-sized pictures are rolling out of his printer. While Emmanuel cuts them into tiny squares, Jorge hands me a piece of paper and a pen.
Write down name, birth date, height, weight, and address. You can use fake ones if you want.
Do your customers ever use real ones?
He shrugs his linebacker shoulders. Don't know, don't care.
I write Beth's full name across the top of the paper, dredging up a middle name on the spot. Louise, a character from some book I just read. I give Beth 2 extra years, born on February 20th, 1983. She's my height, 5'8", but I tack on a few pounds. The best way to hide in plain sight, I've decided, is to put some more meat on my bones with a strict pizza, donut, hamburger, and french fry diet. Her address is the one for Morgan House. I hand the paper back to Jorge, and he holds out a meaty palm. 350, right? He grunts.
Funny.
I contemplate the wisdom of forking over the money now before I've gotten my ID cards. But I'm not exactly in a position of power here. I slap the $375 I already peeled off my stash into his hand. Jorge counts it, then counts it again.
What's your number?
He says, pulling out his phone. I open my mouth, then stop myself just in time. The only number I know by heart is my real number, for the phone sitting at the bottom of a trash can back in Arkansas. My new number, the one for the prepay phone in my back pocket, is a blank. I haven't memorized it yet. I don't remember. Jorge heaves a sigh that reeks of cheese and jalapeno, and the look he gives me says, amateur. He rattles off a string of numbers that I realize too late is for his cell phone. Hang on. I fumble for my phone, and he repeats the numbers, this time slower, while I type them in. I hit send, and his cell phone lights up in his hand. He flips it so I can see.
Your number. I call you when ready.
How long? He lifts a meaty shoulder.
30 minutes, maybe more. Wait at Sonic up the road.
It is 73 eternal minutes before a shiny black SUV rolls into the Sonic parking lot. I watch from my table by the window as a man who is definitely not Jorge. Too dark, much too skinny, slides out. He looks up and down the parking lot like a villain on an episode of Cops, then tucks a manila envelope under the Buick's windshield wiper and hustles back into his car. By the time I make it outside, the man is long gone. I pluck the envelope from the windshield and drop into my car, my fingers shaking as I slide my nail under the flap. I jiggle the envelope upside down, and two small squares drop onto my lap. One is paper, a Social Security card with a bright yellow "Sign Here" sticker. The other is plastic, a driver's license that looks as real as any I've ever seen. I examine it, turning it back and forth in a shaft of sunlight, and the hologram Georgia seal brightens and fades. The signature is not mine, but it's generic enough that with a little practice I can duplicate it. Other than that, it's perfect. Beth Louise Murphy is legit. My cell phone rings with a number I recognize as Jorge's cell. I pick up to the sound of chewing.
You get ID?
I did get ID, thank you. I toss the cards on the passenger's seat and start the car.
They look great, totally real.
He grunts, a sound I take to mean, you're welcome.
Listen, you have friends who need ID, you send them to Jorge. $50 every friend.
And there it is, I think, as I ease the Buick into traffic. What Martino wanted from me.
Marcus. The Pine Bluff Police Department is housed in a squat one-story complex on East 8th Avenue, blinding white stucco against a sprawling green lawn. The place is a dump, dingy walls and scuffed linoleum floors, but on a bright note, we're understaffed enough that the detectives get their own private rooms. They're cramped and stuffy, but they're a million times better than a desk in the bullpen they surround. Jeffrey and Ingrid arrive a full 12 minutes late, and just like yesterday, the two are practically vibrating with animosity. He opens the door for her, but only because I'm watching, prompting a thanks she doesn't want to give. These two people detest each other, and I want to know why. I gesture for them to follow. This way. I usher them through the rowdy bullpen to the open door of my office. Have a seat, I say, gesturing to the twin chairs across from my desk, but only Ingrid sinks into one. Jeffrey is frozen just outside the door. He pokes his head into the room, and his relief when he sees it's an office is palpable. The sucker thought this was going to be an interrogation room. I raise a brow, and reluctantly he steps inside, sinks into a chair. I round my desk and drop into mine. We found Sabine's car. What? The two say in unison, their voices high and wild. Oh my God, where? Ingrid says. When? And that's good news, right? It means you have some idea which way she went. I don't shake my head, but I don't nod either. A car is not necessarily good news, especially one like Sabine's, undamaged and untouched. So far, the only DNA we found on it is hers. The car was parked at the far end of the Super One lot on East Harding. According to the security footage, she walked through the door yesterday at 1:49 p.m. 10 minutes later, she purchased a loaf of bread, some sliced turkey and cheese, and a lemonade. She paid with her ATM card and was out the door by 2:03 p.m. The cameras don't cover the entire parking lot, unfortunately, so we lost her soon after. Ingrid scoots to the front edge of her seat. I don't understand. You're saying she never made it back to her car? It sure looks that way. We searched the lot and trash cans for the groceries without any luck. Somebody could have picked them up, or maybe she took them with her. With her where? Ingrid shakes her head. What are you saying, exactly? You both mentioned you talked to Sabine. I flip through my notes, pausing to find the right page. Ingrid at 10:45 a.m. and Jeffrey, I look up, meeting his gaze. You didn't actually tell me a time. I was at the Atlanta airport, boarding a flight. The DL-2088, I know. Jeffrey told me he talked to Sabine as he was boarding his flight, but he didn't say which one. He didn't even mention the airline. I did a little digging. The flight left Atlanta at 11:30 a.m., I say. So boarding would have been, what, a half hour earlier? He nods, shifting in his chair. Yeah, 11 sounds about right. I can pull it up on my call log if you need the exact time and duration. I ignore his offer, turning to Ingrid instead. In either of these conversations with Sabine, did she mention where she was going? Jeffrey shakes his head, but Ingrid nods. She was on her way to the office. I frown. Not the answer I was expecting. This particular Super One is nowhere near her work. I checked with her office, and she didn't have any showings that morning, only a staff training later in the afternoon at the office, which she missed. Oh, she had a showing, all right, Jeffrey says, his voice thick with sarcasm and something else. Anger, for sure. Disgust, too. And more than a little pain. Ingrid looks over with a frown. Sabine was coming from the hospital. His lip curls into an ugly sneer. Her lover told me she dropped by for a little conjugal visit. I lean back in my chair. By now, I know about the affair. Dr. McAdams already told me, tripping all over himself in his hurry for a face-to-face, a million questions disguised as a statement. The poor guy is desperate for answers, almost too desperate to be believable. Well, if she was coming from the hospital, the route makes more sense. She could have stopped to buy herself a late lunch. And then what? Ingrid squirms on her chair, clutching her hands. Where did she go next? Well, it's certainly not out of the realm of possibility that Sabine left on her own accord, that she got into a car with a colleague or a friend, but my gut says no. For one thing, she wouldn't have left her cell phone behind. We found it in the car, charging in the cup holder. I was hoping one of you could identify it for us. I pull an evidence bag from my desk drawer, holding it up to show the Samsung smartphone inside. Ingrid releases a loud, relieved breath. That's not Sabine's. Are you sure the car you found is the right one? Maybe you made a mistake. Again, not the answer I was expecting. The phone was found in Sabine's locked car. Who else's could it be? Are you positive? We haven't been able to check it, not without the code. 100%, Ingrid says. Sabine has an iPhone, a white one, the newest model. I look to Jeffrey for confirmation. It's true, she does have an iPhone. He stabs a finger at the Samsung. But that's probably her burner phone. Ingrid's face whips to his. What the hell are you talking about? Sabine doesn't have a burner phone. Don't be ridiculous. Yes, Ingrid, she does. The one that for the past 5 months she's been using to talk to her lover. Ingrid twitches, and his smile is a mix of mean and condescending. Looks like she doesn't quite tell you everything, does she? Ingrid slumps in the chair, and Jeffrey turns to me. Dr. Trevor McAdams, chief obstetrician at Jefferson Regional Hospital. I believe you spoke with him last night. I'm guessing if you crack the code on that phone, every number on the call log will be his. Try 826-637, Ingrid mumbles. It's the one she uses for her iPhone. I pluck a plastic bag from the box on the sill, wriggle my hand inside, then shove it in the bag and tick in the code. The login dissolves into a colorful home screen with neat columns of apps. The icon for phone has a bright red number in the top right corner, 23 missed calls. I tap it, and they're all from the same number, which matches the one scribbled on my pad. You were right. It's the number for Dr. McAdams's cell. Ingrid shifts in her chair with a huff. I reseal the bag, peel off the glove, and drop both in my desk drawer. This doesn't explain where the iPhone is, though. We've put out a trace on that number, but we're not finding anything. Looks like wherever it is, she's turned it off. And according to her bank, the transaction at the Super One was the last purchase she made. She hasn't used her credit card or ATM card since. There were also no big withdrawals in the weeks before, which tells me she wasn't planning on making a run for it. Of course she wasn't, Ingrid says. Sabine wouldn't run, not without telling me. Sometime in the past few minutes, she started to cry. Her face is messy with it. Red eyes, mottled cheeks, swollen, dripping nose. She sniffs and swipes at it with a sleeve. So, what now? Where do we look next? Well, we've begun questioning Super One staff who were working Wednesday's shift. We're hopeful that one of them saw something out of the ordinary, or maybe someone out of the ordinary. I've also put out an APB for anyone matching Sabine's description, which means we've got a lot more than just our eyes looking for her. We're going through her bank records, her credit card usage, anything that will help us trace her movements. We'll be interviewing her friends, her colleagues, all the people in her life, and before you ask, that includes Dr. McAdams, and we'll be asking them the same question I'm asking you. Where were you Wednesday afternoon from 1 p.m. on? An alibi. I'm asking them for an alibi. The two exchange a look. Ingrid folds her arms across her chest, her expression a mixture of insult and concern. I work at home. I'm a virtual assistant. People pay me to arrange their schedules, type up reports, handle their social media, things like that. Was anyone there with you? I ask. I live alone. Okay. Is there anyone who can verify your whereabouts? A neighbor, maybe, or a client who called on the house line? No, she says, then brightens. But I was online all day. I can prove I was there with the IPs from websites I visited and the emails in my sent folder. You know how to do that. Jeffrey sounds dubious, like he doesn't think she's that capable. Yes, she says, slow and satisfied. I have a degree in computer science. Mentally, I shuffle the sister to the bottom of my list. Ingrid is a spinster, the kind of woman who lives alone, works alone, stays alone. But so far, everything I've seen and heard from her seems sincere. As suspects go, she's not a strong one. Jeffrey, on the other hand, he checks all the boxes, every single one. He clears his throat, folds his hands atop his lap. Well, let's see. I landed at just after noon or so. I nod, at 12.05 p.m. Surprise flashes across his face, though it shouldn't. I already told him I looked up his flight number, which means I'll also know when he landed. I'm not a small-town cop, and I've done my homework. Your plane arrived at the gate at 12.11, I say, without consulting my notes. By 12.24, everyone but the crew had deplaned. Okay, he says, thinking. But I was all the way in the back, so one of the last people off the plane, and then it took forever to get my bag. The Little Rock Airport is notoriously slow. After that, I grabbed some lunch. At the airport? No, at a little Italian place near the airport. I don't remember the name. Ingrid makes a sound. Convenient. What time was this? I ask. I don't know. After one, for sure. Maybe closer to 1:30. Did you use a card? I paid cash. Ingrid gives up all pretense. She blows out a sigh, long and loud, and sits up straight in her chair. She's ready for me to arrest him, to slap some cuffs on him, and cart him downstairs. What time did you get back to Pine Bluff? He shrugs. I think it was around 4 or so. Your neighbor, a Mrs. Ashby, confirms it to be around 4:10. She remembers because she was watching a rerun of Ellen, who just finished her dance. Mrs. Ashby was in the kitchen during the commercial break making herself a snack. He makes a noise deep in his throat. More likely pouring herself a drink. Rita Ashby is a nosy old hag whose face is pressed to the kitchen window more often than not. She's also a drunk. In all those years we've lived there, I don't think I've ever seen her sober. He's trying to distract me, buy some time. He knows the question coming next. Why so late? When he doesn't immediately answer, I add, I mean, by my math, even accounting for the baggage delay and the lunch stop and afternoon traffic, which we all know can be a real bitch, you should have been home by 2:30 p.m. at the latest. How come you were so late? What were you doing for that hour and a half? His shrug is trying too hard, as is his tone, too high and much too smooth. It was a nice day, and I'd spent all week cooped up inside at a conference. Don't tell my boss, but I really didn't want to go back to the office. I stopped off at a park along the river to read. Which park? Tar Camp. A forested recreation area popular with families and fishermen, about halfway between Little Rock and Pine Bluff. Emma and I used to go camping there, back when we were newlyweds. I scribbled the name on my pad. How long did you stay?
An hour and a half, maybe longer.
What were you reading?
The CEO of one of our biggest competitors just came out with a book, Stoking the Fire at Work, or some such nonsense. My boss is making everyone at the office read it. Honestly, it's not very good.
Did you see anybody there?
It's a public park, he says, getting defensive. I saw lots of people.
What I meant was, did any of them notice you? A guy in business attire sitting by himself on a park bench.
It was a picnic table. There's a cluster of them at the edge of the river.
He pauses to glance at Ingrid, whose brows are bunched in a skeptical frown.
And I was in jeans and a polo, travel attire.
Still, a guy all alone at a picnic table, reading a book. I'd imagine you stood out.
I'd imagine so, but tell me this, detective. How am I supposed to find them?
I dip my head, ceding the point. Not that it helps him any. Even if he had been at Tar Camp, it's not like any of the people there would remember him, and they certainly wouldn't have exchanged names and numbers. But the bigger point is, he's lying. All the signs are there. The stare down across my desk, the way his breath comes quicker, the microscopic flashes of panic I keep catching on his face. Something about his story is not true. Help me out here, Jeffrey. I just want to make sure I'm not missing anything. I lean toward him, hands folded on top of a sloppy pile of papers. According to what you just told me, you were alone all afternoon yesterday, either in your car, at an unnamed restaurant, or in a public park, from around 12:30 p.m. until a little after 4, when the neighbor confirms you pulled into your driveway. He nods.
That's right, yes.
Add sweating to the list. His face has gone shiny, sprouting a million wet pinpricks.
And at no point during those 3.5 hours, the same hours your wife walked out of the Super One on East Harding and disappeared, can anyone but you verify your whereabouts. He's silent for long enough, I almost feel sorry for him. He sucks a breath, then 2 more, 13 brain-numbing seconds, and then the best he can do is, pretty much. I try to hold my expression tight, but the smile sneaks out anyway. Gotcha.
Beth. I pull to a stop in the middle of the 2-lane drive, double-check the address on the post-it note Martina handed me earlier this morning, and gawk at the building before me. A church. Martina works at a church. A neo-Gothic monstrosity of beige brick and stained glass, with crimson gables and scalloped finials and lancet arches. In the very center of the main tower, a rose window stares out like the eye of a cyclops. Above it, at the steepest point of the roof line, a wooden cross reaches with long arms into a pale blue sky. The Church of Christ's 12 Apostles. Oh, hell no. My hand clenches around the gear shift, jiggling it into reverse. The church and I aren't exactly on the best of terms. Not since I went to the leader of mine for guidance, and he refused to unshackle me from a monster. It's perfectly normal to argue, Father Ian had told me. All couples do, but the successful couples learn to forgive. They put the resentment behind them and move on. I nodded my head in pious agreement. I understand that, Father, but he hurts me.
Hurts you how?
For a second or two, I considered pulling up my shirt and showing him my cracked ribs. In the end, I settled on, with his hands.
Closed or open?
I'm sorry?
His hands, when he hurts you, are they closed or open?
The logical part of me understands Father Ian's reluctance to believe you would be capable of such cruelty. He's known you most